It's a classic tale. It's not money that's the problem, it's the love of money. And also not loving your family. And being a moron. And drugs. And a bunch of other stupid shit. Tonight, a case of actual true crime.
The growing calls across the nation to defund the police.
To end policing as we know it.
With the mysterious disappearance of four people.
Police found what they called an unusual amount of blood in the family home, though whose blood is unclear.
And the suspect isn't talking.
Guns up, giddy up, wolf pack. It's Failure to Stop. It's your favorite podcast. It's the number one podcast and platform where we entertain and inform first responders and we annoy and depress their friends. I'm John. I'm an actual real live 911 dispatcher. I've worked in a sheriff's office for 9 years. I worked in a state penitentiary with some of our state's most dangerous criminals for 6.5. I was a security guard at Target for 2.5. Hey, Kendra's here as well. She's a former sheriff's deputy. She was a sheriff's deputy for over 25 years.
It's true.
Hey, Kendra. Kendra's also my ex-wife, and a condition of our divorce is that we're forced to do a weekly true crime podcast together. Kendra, it's been a week since I've talked to you because a wedge of alienation is growing between us, even though we have a bizarre divorce situation. What is the completely made-up bullshit anecdote that you have to convince our listeners that you are a fully formed and well-rounded actual three-dimensional human being?
You throw me off with that shit so bad.
Can't think of even one thing that happened to you this week that proves you are real and not in an AI.
Well, I genuinely have a very boring life. So, I mean, honestly, I go to work, I stare at a computer screen. I come home, I stare at the wall. I did rearrange all of my books, and I dusted them this week, which is a feat because I have quite a bit of literary possession.
Okay.
In the form of books.
Dusted books, guys, for the love of God. You know, maybe you should get a book from the library about how to like make up interesting anecdotes. If you want to send a book to Kendra, you could. She's got a P.O. box. Post Office Box 1060, DeLand, Florida, 32724. That's Post Office Box 1060, DeLand, Florida, 32724. You could send her hair, toenail clippings, one of those letters that's made up of magazine letters that are all somehow very threatening, sinister child drawings, a mixtape.
Ooh, send me a mixtape.
Send her a mixtape. Kendra doesn't really like music. Before the show, she screams a lot. She burps a lot, which is so unladylike. And then she'll like wander around the house and she thinks I can't hear it. She's like singing music out loud. She's a very musical person. So she would love your mixtape.
Oh, John.
Am I telling too many stories of the real you? If you want to send her a true crime story, for the love of God, don't put them in the chats. Every week, someone's like, John, you have got to tell the story of this and this and this.
Email it to me, please.
Email it. And not just email. Don't just send Kendra an email that says, well, you've got to do this Schenectady 7. Send a Wikipedia article, send a news article, a picture of you committing the crime. Send cases to truecrimedrama@gmail.com. That's truecrime, JRAMA@gmail.com.
I would really like it. What?
Stop putting them in the chat. Send it in an email.
I would really like it if people could start making dioramas of scenes from their favorite cases and sending me either the actual diorama or pictures of the diorama.
Dioramas can be sent to P.O. Box 1060, DeLand, Florida.
And if you don't know what a diorama is, I don't know what to tell you.
If you don't know what a diorama is, you don't know us because we're diorama people around here. The show is brought to you by Ghostbed. The number one preferred bed of murdered people throughout the world. That's Ghostbed, you know. Go to ghostbed.com.
Is there ghosts?
Yes. Use the offer code Wolfpack you could save up to 40%, possibly up to 50%, possibly more. GhostBed has been a sponsor, a Failure to Stop, since long before I got here. Kendra, I don't know if we're quite there yet, but I think I've appeared in more episodes on Failure to Stop than Mike the Cop. Just something to think about.
It's a lot, John.
Yeah, especially since you weren't even here back then, even as a listener. So you have no idea who Mike the Cop even is.
No, I've never heard of him before, right now.
Before right now. No, no, I love Mac the Cop. I'm a big fan.
Matt the Cop.
Matt the Cop. I dare you the next time you're on a podcast with Eric or something, just casually drop it like, yeah, this is like back when you were with Mac the Cop.
I'll just change his name every single time.
I don't think Eric would notice, is the hilarious part. Anyway, I'm doing a GhostBed ad read. Go over to the website for GhostBed. Use the offer code Wolfpack. Let them know that you love Failure to Stop. That Wolfpack code is just for you, the Wolfpack. That way they know that their advertising here makes sense. They should continue to fund Failure to Stop. They give some money to Kendra and some to me, and that preserves Kendra from slavery. That's what we save every single week. So support the podcast. I appreciate the super chats. Last week we had some people drop some money in the super chats. I want you to know that money goes directly to Eric, not to us. You can't earmark it for us. You can't say this is Kendra's money or John's money or True Crime's money. It's just Eric just downloads it into his bank account and then like spends it as candy for his children. So, I mean, I guess go ahead and super chat for Elkin Pansy, everybody. Give it up for that little skateboarding kid. Your super chats just support children, I guess, which I'm against. So if you wanted to send money, you could send it in a self-addressed stamped envelope to P.O. Box, DeLand, Florida, 32724. 32724, and at the end of the show, we'll actually be dropping Kendra's Venmo information as well. But GhostBed is the only mattress company that makes mattresses in the good old United States of America. If you're a first responder, you need good sleep. Invest in yourself. Invest in your sleep. It's sleep so good it's scary. It's Christopher Nolan style lasagna layered sleep in which you are having dreams of being asleep. It's a damn good mattress company. Go over there. When you wake up in the morning, there should be food in your house that should have been delivered there. If there's food in your house and you brought it to your own house from grocery shopping, well, you're some kind of idiot. I don't know why you did that, because Factor Meals exist. They'll bring food right to your house. Go to their website. You can pick from over 300 delicious options. You don't have to eat on a whim. You could do your meal planning all online from the comfort of and the safety of the internet. You could go on there and pick out what you want for a week, how many deliveries. It gets delivered fresh to your house. You can decide how many you want every week and set it all up in advance. You don't have to be one of these people that's, you know, eating a bologna sandwich or try to pack up something before you go on your shift. You can have it all set up in advance, and it works out great. So we encourage you to go over to Factor Meals. Use the code WOLFPACK50. We really appreciate them. This is Meg. Meg is a big Factor Meals. Meg does not listen to this podcast at all. So podcast listeners, this is Meg here, seen with a reluctant puppy. Puppy that doesn't want to be having its picture taken with Meg. But here's Meg. She does not watch the podcast at all, but Meg does love her Factor Meal. She's a very busy college student. She's going for a degree in boneology. So every single, I don't remember what the degree is. She told me that brains are like, she said that a skull is like a Panera bread and your brain is like a soup once. So like she's in the study of Panera of pathology. She doesn't watch the podcast at all. She thinks other podcasts are better prepared and more well-researched than us. Meg doesn't watch the show. All right. So Meg uses Factor Meals. The wellness company is also a sponsor of this show. Although Megan looks like she was working at a human clinic, she was actually working at one for animals. You don't have to get your prescription medications and supplements from the vet if you're a human being. You can go to the wellness company. You can own your health, your wellness, and your freedom with the wellness company. Get well and stay well with solutions designed by top doctors. They got natural supplements like melatonin to help you sleep, immune support, daily essentials for your mind and energy, and prescription meds like antibiotics if you need it. You could stock up before the next emergency. Medical kits, contagion kits, first aid kits. If you get a membership, you can free yourself entirely from Big Pharma. The wellness company, use the offer code Wolfpack. You can save 10%. And we appreciate them supporting us. It's all about being ready, which you can also do with CountyCom. CountyCom is everything you need to prepare, explore, and survive. That's not medicine, food, or mattresses. Go to CountyCom and check out their online store for powerful flashlights, utility knives, multi-tools, mechanical watches, radios, compasses, fire starter kits, lighters, bags, watches, pouches. If you need it to survive when you're roughing it, if society has collapsed and you've got your factor meal and your ghost bed pillow, and what was the other thing? Your factor meal and your wellness and your antibiotics. What you need left is going to be supplied by CountyCom. You don't want to be caught unprepared, so go over there and get it. You can trust them. They've been in business almost as long as I've been alive, longer than Kendra's been alive. Kendra's entire existence is subsumed by the business operations of CountyCom. They offer free returns and exchanges, free domestic shipping on orders over on $25. They got good rewards programs over there. Go to CountyCom. That's CountyCom, C-O-M-M.com. Follow them on Instagram. Everybody likes a prepared guy. Be that guy with CountyCom. Absolutely. Thank you so much to CountyCom for supporting me and nobody else. And a reminder, Meg does not watch this podcast at all. God damn it, Meg. All right. So we wanted to talk about this case. Today we're doing the Klaus family murders. Wait, I'm getting an update on the Ayla Reynolds case from last week. That's right. We're going to pull this podcast over. I talk about last week's missing persons case. That's right, the disappearance of Ayla Reynolds. Because as it turns out, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. And you just make shit up. That's apparently the charge leveled against us and the charge that we are leveling back at people. I've got a couple things I want to address. Or do you want to go first?
It sounds like you have a good segue coming up, so I'll let you go.
I have no good segues. Meg doesn't watch the show. That's my segue from now on. It's just mentioning how Meg doesn't do shit around here. So we had somebody in our chats last week, which we appreciate new people coming to the show, but they claimed that we left out a lot of damning evidence against Justin, the father of Ayla Reynolds, and we believe that we may not have done Ayla Reynolds justice in our podcast. There's a couple things that I wanted to address in terms of the evidence that was suggested for that case, the things that we should be bringing forward. The long text messages that were sent to Kendra and Eric about this, they literally went and told our boss on us. I don't know how you feel about that, Kendra.
I think if you feel like we didn't cover something or you, you can reach out to Eric. It's fine, but it's
you can also email stuff to truecrimedrama at gmail.com. Mm-hmm. You don't have to tell our boss on us. He was confused. He doesn't watch the show either, just like Meg doesn't watch the show. So.
He just sent me the screenshots. He's like, here, if you want to reach out to this person.
Yeah.
And I did. So just email or DM me or
you can look at pictures or truecrime_drama on Instagram. That's the way you can do that. One of the things that was brought up was is that we should do better to represent the facts of the case in order to honor Ayla Reynolds. Ayla Reynolds was 19 months old when she was abducted or disappeared or some kind of harm befell her. We are not anti Ayla Reynolds, but you need to understand this podcast is not here to honor Ayla Reynolds. We are a first responders podcast. She is a former sheriff's deputy. I'm an active 911 dispatcher in the field. The only thing that we honor is the pursuit of the truth within the confines of the law. We're not here to be on anyone's side. Yeah, like we're not anti a 19-month-old child who certainly met a terrible fate. We're also human beings with hearts that care about that child, but that's not the purpose of this podcast. We didn't set out on this podcast to say we need to honor the victims. In fact, there's a lot of podcasts out there that seem to do that. They almost want to prey on your sense of your own personal sense of justice and say justice for the victims. In fact, many, many true crime podcasts are like that. You know, we need to get, we need to get justice for someone. We need to get justice for Ayla. And I'm also being exhorted to go through many aspects of the case. I was given a whole list of things that happened in this case, like Ayla disappears. I don't know what you thought was in our podcast, but we actually did cover the fact that she was disappeared. We covered that there was blood spatter in the house. We covered that the evidence was attempted to be cleaned up as you would blood. I mean, if you got blood in your house, you would attempt to clean up. We covered that there were no arrests made, and that was unreal. In the chats, you said that the police failed. I told you that police gather evidence and that it's up to a state's attorney to take that evidence in front of a grand jury to get an indictment. That's the next case if you're trying to seek a conviction against someone. The state's attorney's office in Maine is the one that said, I don't have enough to get an indictment. So before you say that the police failed, maybe you should just sit down and watch an episode of Law and Order, because you'll learn that in the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups: the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. Law and Order is those stories. Just so you know. Yes, thank you. That was so perfectly well done. Before you say the police failed, it's entirely possible that the police gathered every piece of evidence that they could, and that they could not go forward with that to even get an indictment. An indictment means is that a jury looks at this evidence, a grand jury, and says, we think that you have enough to proceed with a criminal trial. Go ahead and take him in front of another jury, and we'll see if this is enough for a jury to think that we can determine whether or not he's guilty. So it's up to a state's attorney to decide whether or not to do that. You can get an indictment and then not go any further than that, but they don't have enough evidence even to go for an indictment. I was also exhorted to do this. It would be fabulous if you can report it like this to set the scene and to get people on board. This is such a classic true crime scenario. I'm going to tell you right now, I work in a sheriff's office. Kendra used to work in one. We don't give a fuck about any true crime podcast. A podcast is not about activating people, getting people on board, because police officers and administrators don't care that someone is listening to Failure to Stop. They don't care that someone's listening to a whole podcast called Justice for Ayla. They don't even really care that people are watching the news about it. Yeah, I mean, there's such a thing as political pressure, but you're fooling yourself if you think that Failure to Stop as a podcast is going to do anything for Ayla Reynolds, and that's not what we're here for. Again, I'm not anti-Ayla Reynolds, but we're not here to bring justice for her. We're here to tell you the facts of the case as we understand them. And we're doing that as people who are involved in law enforcement. And what that means is that we're not going to traffic in uncorroborated and salacious innuendo and rumors and things that we cannot substantiate. You and I were in the chats and we were talking about how everyone knows that Justin left in the middle of the night. The police know that he left in the middle of the night. And I talked to you in these chats and I said, but how? But how? You can't just say, well, people know things, because people just knowing things is called hearsay and it's not admissible as evidence. So to get something admitted into court, you have to have someone who can be cross-examined, meaning a witness who says, I saw Justin get in his vehicle with a tote and drive away. Or you have to have some sort of physical evidence. The cops, for no reason at all, took a picture of his odometer before he went to sleep and before they got there in the morning. Or this talk about how he was in Portland. I'm not aware that his vehicle was low-jacked or that someone was following him as he went to Portland. There's a lot of conjecture in this case, and there always is in every true crime case. And what makes Failure to Stop true crime different is that although we can come across all these same things that you come across, we don't put them in this podcast if we don't think that they're necessarily the truth. Now, sometimes we do speculate. That's fine. It's okay to say, what could our leads be? But just saying the police know that he did it and they didn't arrest him, the police failed, I take exceptional offense to that. And it's not that you have to worry about my feelings, but I'm telling you right now that I know detectives. I work with police officers. I worked in an office where we've solved homicides. And there's no such thing as a cop that is just going to have a homicide that they're tasked to solve and just don't do their best to do it. As Kendra will get into, that millions of dollars were spent. The FBI was involved. If you're not happy with the Waterville police, if you're not happy with the Maine State Police, then you're not happy with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And you're going to tell me that all these police departments, all these law enforcement agencies, they all just fell down. They all just couldn't get it done. This guy Justin's just smarter than all of them. Give me a break. There's cases that cannot be solved in a court of law. Yeah, I'm anti-Justin. I believe that he did it, but I don't have one goddamn thing that I could take to the Maine state's attorney. And frankly, neither do you. That's going to convince a Maine state attorney at this point to go in front of a jury and try to get that indictment, because otherwise they would already have that and they would have already done those things. So your conjecture that you think that I should put on the show to activate people, it's bullshit. All the things that you think happen, for whatever reason, they're not evidence. They're just things that you believe. And we're not here to honor Ayla Reynolds. That's not the purpose of this podcast. I'm sorry that she is dead. I'm not happy about that. But don't put it on me that it's my job to honor a little girl by reporting it in the way that you think that I should, because all I'm going to talk about is stuff that I know. And these facts that you think you know are not in the public domain because I couldn't find them. They're just stuff that, and I get lots of people saying, well, I lived in Maine at the time. Well, that just means that you were in the rumor mill because, again, all the evidence that's out there, and there's all the evidence is not in the public domain. It's not enough to take to court. And even the stuff that the police have not released, the stuff that's in a box somewhere in an evidence locker, even that is not enough to go get just an indictment. And if you go around arresting Justin, he's going to stop talking. If you make false arrests on other people, something that you said in the chats was that, well, we ought to just arrest one of the other adults in the house and then I'll flip on him.
For maybe what? What are you arresting them for?
Maybe you've been watching too much Law & Order, because to me that sounds like a Law & Order tactic. We'll just go jam up somebody else. That's called false arrest and it's unconstitutional. And if you think that the police should go out and arrest somebody in order to trick someone else or get someone else to flip, then I don't think you realize how civil rights are being curtailed by that. That's a fascist state. That's a police state where the police go around arresting someone, convincing someone else to confess. Would you want the police to arrest you? They think that you know something about a murder or a criminal case or tax fraud. Should they just be able to arrest you and hold you for 24 hours hoping that you'll flip or hit you with some phony baloney charge, even though you had nothing to do with it? So before you demand that the police go out there and violate the civil rights of other people, why don't you put yourself in there? Because whatever happens to them can happen to you. And one final thing is that you don't understand how civil cases work, that someone can be found guilty in a civil court of law of a wrongful death case, and then it doesn't lead to jail time. I explained this in the episode, and I have explained it on multiple episodes. And at this point, I will give you one more explanation. And if it does not work for you, you'll never get it. And I suggest you get out of having true crime as an interest because you're not picking up anything. There's two courts. There's a criminal court that will decide whether or not you're guilty of breaking a criminal law that you can face sanctions up to and including jail time. And there's a civil court. That's called being sued. That's just suing for money or compensation or reimbursement or whatever. So you can sue someone for the wrongful death of someone else. The reward that you get out of that is money. How does that happen, though? It goes in front of a jury, and in a civil court, the standard of guilt is preponderance of evidence. That means 50% plus one. It's literally a scale, and if this side is slightly heavier, the whole thing tips. It doesn't work that way in the criminal justice system. In the criminal justice system and criminal law, for someone to be convicted of a crime, the jury must consider them guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Not all doubt, but all reasonable doubt. That is a much higher standard to reach. So I say this famously, we could not convict O.J. Simpson of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson. We didn't have enough. There was reasonable doubt as far as the jury was concerned. The gloves didn't fit, so they had to acquit. Whatever you think about that, that's what happened. When they took that same case in front of another jury, the jury looked at it like me and Kendra and everyone else in the country that is like, OJ killed that lady. Because the standard wasn't reasonable doubt. It was just preponderance of evidence. It's more likely than not that OJ Simpson killed that person. So in this case, it's more likely than not that Justin's responsible for the disappearance or murder of Ayla Reynolds. I think the mother could easily win that civil case. That's why she's trying so hard to get him sued. But we don't have enough evidence to beat that higher standard in a criminal court of law, because otherwise we would have done it. So don't say the police have failed. How about you recognize that the police have tried, and because this isn't a TV show, we're not always going to get everything that we need. And not only that, but the case isn't over. It's not closed. If someone comes forward at some point, they could testify against Justin, and we can still go after him. There's no statute of limitations on murder. However, if we go after Justin half-cocked and we put it in front of a jury and we show them the evidence we have and there's reasonable doubt, Jeopardy has attached and we'll never be able to try him again. So after Jeopardy's attached, we can't put him in danger twice for the same crime. If someone else comes forward, so what? O.J. Simpson has come out and said that he killed Nicole Brown Simpson. One time a lady walked up to him and said, "Hi, I've never met a murderer before." And he goes, "Hi, nice to meet you." He doesn't say I'm not a murderer. He can write a book about it. He won't make any money, but he can tell people that he killed Nicole Brown Simpson. But because we've already put him in jeopardy for it, we can't try him again. So now if someone comes out and says that Justin killed Ayla after we've already tried him, it won't fucking matter. So why go ahead and go to trial or try to get an indictment half-cocked? You may as well wait for the evidence to drop. You're mad that there's no justice for Ayla? It's not over. We're still working on it. The case is still open. And in terms of this money thing, don't give me a break. That's not about justice for Ayla. That's about a payday for mom. And you think mom is so high and mighty. You think that she's a good person and she deserves, you know, compensation. I was willing to give a little bit of room and say, you know what? Even people who are addicted to heroin and who are aggrieved by their daughters being gone, they can still feel sadness. They may be entitled to compensation. But money doesn't bring back Ayla. Money just, you know, ruins Justin's life. You know, financially, it's just harder for him to have disposable income. It's about a payoff for her. And I said this to Kendra before the show, that the reason why Ayla Reynolds is dead is because she had two parents that didn't love her. Because Ayla Reynolds' mother was a heroin addict. She was caught up in all kinds of shit that she should have never been in as a mother. She was probably doing it before Ayla was born. She was getting in bed with people like Justin, who, as you said, had other domestic violence complaints. He's a bad guy, too. You had two bad people coming together. They made an innocent person, a little baby, and she died either way because she's got two bad parents. Because Ayla should have been with her mom, but mom was in treatment. Ayla was with grandma. So the father has rights, goes to the father, but he's a piece of shit. And what happened. So you can blame both of them, and frankly, I do. And when you're a law enforcement officer, you will realize that there's no true innocent party. And that's part of being objective. The only real innocent person here is Ayla, but, you know, I'm not, like I said, I'm not here to honor her. I'm here to explain the story of her death. A podcast doesn't honor anyone, and it doesn't activate anyone, and it doesn't get anyone on board. And if you think that you're a crusader for justice because you listen to this show or Morbid or any other show, then you're just propping up your own delusions that you're part of the problem. You're not. Now that the whole universe has turned off this show, that's the last episode. True crime is over. Ugh. Go ahead, Kendra.
Well, I mean, you pretty much took the words right out of my mouth. I mean,
I got mad.
Huh?
I got mad. Should we start over?
You should be mad. It's infuriating because this is something that happens a lot with true crime shows, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to do true crime. And when this show was presented to me, I took it because I really like what Failure to Stop is doing. I like the fact that we can come at it from a law enforcement perspective, because that's not something that people do in true crime. There's a couple of shows here and there, but for the most part, it's people like this that... we talked about this last episode where they lead with their emotions, and because there's a toddler involved, you want there to be a solution. And guess what? Sometimes shit just fucking happens, and there's horrible people in this world who commit horrible atrocities, and it's not the cop's fault that that happens. And one of the things that was sent to me, they didn't send it to me. They told me that they chatted with Eric about it, and that it's in that conversation, which that in and of itself tells me that you, for whatever reason, maybe you feel like you don't have much of a leg to stand on because you didn't ask me about it or send me any information. And you basically made me go get it third hand. So I did. I read the article twice. I don't understand what exactly it is that you want us to report more on. A couple of things from that article. The article that was sent is about the wrongful death suit and an update on the suit, in which the sister and mother of Justin are now being implicated as well as defendants in this suit. Again, it's a civil suit, and as John stated earlier, all you need is preponderance of evidence that they were likely involved and that they likely had something to do with her death and or disappearance.
Maybe just the fact that they didn't come forward, maybe they covered it up. Maybe they could be held liable.
It's not a charge. It's not something that you can use in a criminal court.
That's a great point too. So the verdict of a criminal court can be used as evidence in a civil court. The civil stuff's not going to go into a criminal court. That's not evidence of guilt as a civil conviction.
Because it's not good enough.
No.
You have to have actual evidence and enough evidence to show that beyond reasonable doubt, this individual perpetrated this crime, and it just didn't have, it did not happen in this case, probably because Justin did a really good job at covering his tracks, and it fucking happens. It's not the law enforcement officers or agency's fault. As I stated last episode, and John touched on it just now, it is the largest investigation in Maine state history. Do you really think that if government agencies, three of them, invested hundreds of thousands of dollars, time, resources into an investigation, that they would just simply not make a fucking arrest if they had evidence? No. And I'm going to read from that article that you sent, because this is the only thing that I can think that you might believe would point to evidence. Clearly you don't understand the difference between civil and criminal law, which is fine. That's part of the reason why we're here, is to help educate. So I'm going to educate.
And to tear you down.
Well, we're not naming names, but I'm just saying, if you're going to come with an accusatory tone, we're going to not defend ourselves, but
we're also going to tear you a new one if one of the sources that you send to us is a different podcast. I'm not going to listen to Murder She Told.
I didn't even fucking listen to it.
I'm not going to listen to Murder She Told when I don't know that fucking podcaster. For all I know, she's trafficking in the same rumor mill that you are. There's all kinds of extra information in every case that's not worth a damn because it's not good evidence. Go ahead, Kendra.
From this article, quote, sufficient evidence to allege that his mother and sister individually or together with him had the opportunity and means to participate in causing severe injury to Ayla that led to her death. Opportunity and means is not saying that someone had opportunity and means. Is basically saying they were in the right time and place. That's all they're saying.
I've been in a pickup truck with Kendra, and I had a gun concealed in my person. I had opportunity and means, and I didn't kill Kendra.
That doesn't mean anything. The attorney for the case, it would be Trista's attorney who's bringing forth these civil charges, received documents from the attorney general, evidence and documents from Maine State Police investigation. What the hell are those things? We don't know. Just because it has the word evidence on it doesn't mean that it's damning evidence that's going to cause. This is all the evidence for a civil case is literally just, could literally just be, Justin was alive and he was in the home. Therefore he's liable. He had her, she was under his care. He's liable. That's all that fucking means. Confidentiality agreements needed to be completed before any of this could be turned over to any of the other attorneys to make discoverable. In this case, discoverability basically determines what can and can't be brought into the case, because you'll be sad to know that there are things that happen in cases that are not allowed to be brought forth to the court to be considered.
An example of that would be, like, suppose you send an email to your therapist who you have client doctor privileged communication with. That email is discoverable, meaning an attorney can subpoena it, but it doesn't mean it's admissible in court because your therapist and has confidentiality where they mm-hmm. can't divulge that stuff. So there's a discovery phase. And then in every case like this, there's also a phase called the suppression phase, where the good defense attorney right. is going to do their best to say that evidence was gathered improperly in violation of the Constitution. And it's fruit of the poisonous tree. It's the Fourth Amendment. Look it up, pal. This can't come before a jury. And sometimes you'll have very, very, very good evidence that, because it was found in the wrong way, can't go in front of a jury. There's always exceptions to that. There's always inevitable discovery, good faith discovery. There's exceptions that work for the prosecution too. But ultimately, the hearings that are going to go before a court, both the prosecution and defense are going to get their way. And a jury almost never sees the entire case. Keep going.
And that's a prime example of what you just said of why we don't just fucking arrest people and why we don't just fucking charge people. Because if you discover evidence in the wrong way or you violate someone's rights, like you make a false arrest so that you can get information to flip on somebody, guess what? All of that gets thrown out the fucking window and Justin doesn't get convicted of murdering his daughter. On the flip side, the defense attorneys that are Justin's defense for this suit, they say that there's not enough. They have strong legal defenses for Alicia and Phoebe, which I do believe. I don't think they had anything to do with it, in my opinion, especially not Phoebe, because I don't think she was even fucking home the night that it happened. Phoebe is Justin's mother. He also states that there's not enough evidence to prove any claim against DiPietro for anything, including the death of Ayla. And they would know if there was, because all of that evidence has now been turned over. All of the quote evidence has been turned over from the petitioner to a woman from the life insurance company, and all of this stuff that's being discovered and all the evidence that's being turned over. The deadline is the 12th of next month. This is a very active thing that's happening, right? But all that being said, okay, this is just a civil suit. It means nothing when it comes to criminal charges. It really means absolutely nothing. And, but I don't want to ramble too much. We're already at 36 minutes, but I think this particularly got under our skin because we make it a point to not, we make it a very strong point to stay objective and to present information that is, first of all, relevant and accurate. We're not going to sit here and rile up and play on your emotion to get you to feed into an agenda or a belief like other podcasts do, simply because a toddler is involved and someone needs to be held responsible. We're not anti-Ayla. We both agree that Justin had something to do with it if he was not the perpetrator of a murder. But the problem, the point is, just because you can deduce something and you know in your heart of hearts that something has occurred, you have to have evidence and you have to stay objective if you want justice to be carried out. You cannot get the true crime community is riddled with internet sleuths and people who think that they're fucking detectives and they think that they're smarter than law enforcement. I'll tell you, I was a patrol deputy. I was never an investigator. I didn't have any sort of special anything like that. And there were cases, major cases, that I wasn't privy to. I was not privy to all of the information that a major case unit was investigating. And there's a reason why. You are not fucking special simply because you're angry about it. And I don't, it really, really, really pisses me off. Because that's how misinformation gets spread and it hinders investigations. You're not helping, you're making it worse. Especially, we've mentioned it once before, but I think it was Morbid took credit for one of the true crime. They took credit for the Gabby Petito
case. They said it was the true crime community that put the pressure on police to resolve the disappearance of Gabby Petito.
Law enforcement does not give a fuck about a true crime podcast. I'll tell you that right now.
If it were not for the quote unquote true crime community, which by the way, CrimeCon is not a community, it's a commercial scam. There's no true crime community. You putting on your headphones and listening to Morbid or Failure to Stop or Murder, She Told doesn't make you part of a community. No one's downloading the numbers saying, guess how big our audience is, and sending that over to a police chief. You're fooling yourself if you think that you're taking in a commercial product that has ghost beds in it and think that you're doing anything for anyone. And this is my final point. In the chats, you're also talking about motive. Yeah, we discussed motive. Justin apparently took out a life insurance policy. Here's something you need to know. Here's a memo from the real world. Motive doesn't matter. The reason why somebody does something is actually not an element of a crime. It doesn't matter. Sometimes people kill for no reason. There's people that run people down on buses just for no reason. They run people over walking on the side of the road. They kill their wives. They kill their sons. They kill their daughters. They kill their neighbors. They steal. They lie. They do it for no reason. Motive's not an element in a criminal case. The TV shows make it out like it is. You need three mm-hmm. things: means, motive, and opportunity. No, that is something that is a storytelling device. The motive is the best part. It's the most compelling thing. Learning why somebody did something is very good for Olivia Benson and SVU. But in the real life, you don't ever have to explain to a jury why anyone ever did. If you can prove that they did it with evidence, whether it's circumstantial or direct, both fine, by the way. You've heard the phrase, it's all the evidence was circumstantial. Circumstantial evidence is evidence. That's another one of those things that TV shows get wrong. But you don't have to convince anyone of motive. And we also discussed this too, but he took out a life insurance policy. It's sketch as fuck, as the kids would say. Do you know that if he even got paid? Did he get paid? Because he said that she was missing. Life insurance doesn't pay out upon missing. In fact, Justin may only have gotten paid once Trista had her declared dead. It's entirely possible the two of them that are colluding for a payday. Honestly, here's a theory for you. It's possible that they were both in it together. He takes out the life insurance policy. When she's dead, he gets paid the life insurance. And then she sues him for wrongful death or whatever, and she gets a payday out of that. It's just a way of converting a baby into a payday. I'm not saying that they did collude. I'm just saying you can't say that motive was the reason why it happened. What I just said, it's not evidence. Even if it's a good theory or if it's compelling and it's great for an episode of SVU, it doesn't mean anything when you're trying to prove the elements of a crime to a jury, Kendra.
And if you, first of all, another comment that was made by this person was that Trista did not act inappropriately in their opinion. Have you watched the interviews?
What a joke. You've never been around victims before.
Have you watched? You've never been around someone who's fucking high also and wants money. Someone who, and I am not here to judge addicts. That's not what we're doing. But the fact of the matter is, when people are desperate for certain things, they will do crazy, awful things. And yes, they will do them to their own fucking children. I have been present for people are fucking horrible. And you need to get your head out of your ass. This irritates me too. If you think for one second that Trista would not have colluded with Justin to do this in order to get money and fame, you are very naive and you're sadly mistaken. I have been present for many cases of child abuse in which mothers are prostituting their toddlers for cash to get high. Okay? So please, please step out of your bubble for one second and look at
just,
this.
Just be objective.
What it is.
Just be objective and know what actually goes on in what goes on in your neighborhood. The stuff that's too salacious to go on TV.
And I'm not blaming, we're not pushing allegations of any of this on anybody.
No, we're not. But both Kendra and I have real life experience with criminal investigations on some level. We've got more than the common person. We've got more than Murder, She Told. We've got more than Morbid. And the whole point of this podcast is we bring that informed experience to bear. Am I Drew Breezy? No, I don't have all of his experience. Kendra's not a homicide detective either. But we know something about how cases work, and we have been around police officers for combined very long time, and we know how TV shows get it wrong. And like Kendra said, they appeal to your emotions, and you want justice for Ayla. I just want the law to be enforced. Mm-hmm. That's my view. Murder's against the law. Let's enforce the law. And let's not rush to judgment in a criminal court and ultimately shoot ourselves in the foot and completely destroy all chances that we get at putting Justin away for the rest of his life. And it'll be too bad, right? If that's late in his life and he goes to jail at the age of 89 for killing his daughter. That's the system, though. And you can't and you cannot say, well, we need to just falsely arrest other people in order to hurry this up. The wheels of justice don't turn on your clock, pal. I'm sorry about that. And I know that you feel bad for this little girl, but you need to be objective. And if you are a cop, you cannot go and investigate a crime and be that way. I mentioned Olivia Benson earlier. That's why I can't stand SVU, because she's always like, we've got to get justice for the victims. She's one of the most unrealistic police officers that you've ever seen. And if you want to listen to true crime and if you want to feel things for victims, that's fine. But don't kid yourself into thinking that you know better than the police, that you know better than the Maine State Police, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Waterville PD, all these other special agencies that went out, were draining rivers looking for this kid, than the Maine State Attorney's Office, that you know better than them on what constitutes evidence that's going to convince a jury I mean, if you think that there's just evidence lying around that we're not taking forward and we're just being lazy, then you think that you're smarter and better than the police. And you think that because of your experience with true crime podcasts and TV shows like NCIS and whatever else. And you don't have a real, and I could say this with conviction, that you don't have a foot in the criminal justice system. I don't care if your uncle was some detective or something, because you don't know how the system works. And what you're asking for, and by saying the police fail, it proves that you don't understand police and that you don't understand what their job is or why, or frankly, how much work was put into it.
And one more thing, and then I'll be tapped out on this. If you find yourself listening to true crime or any sort of entertainment or media outlet or anything like that, and you find that they're all saying the same thing, it's time to reassess and maybe ask some questions. Because typically, if everyone is saying the same thing or has the same mentality, what you're doing is you're putting yourself in an echo chamber, and more than likely, it's inaccurate. That's what I've found. Typically, when everyone is saying the same thing, it's wrong. It's wrong.
And true crime podcasts do this quite a bit. With the Ayla Reynolds case, I listened to two different podcasts. They were copy and paste. One person listened to one podcast and then they just repeated it for clicks and likes for themselves.
Yep.
I listen to those things and I see what in there is good and what in there is conjecture and what's speculation and what's bad and what are things that just don't make sense. But also, we have a bit on this show, and we haven't done it in a while, but sometimes we play other podcasts' stupidest takes, where we take a podcast like Morbid and we put them on blast to our rather small audience. And we say, this is what happens when your Ugg boots are too tight and your soy milk latte has turned and you think that you know better than cops, because you would say something like, it's only because of us that we got, you know, Brian Landry for killing Gabby Petito.
That shit makes me, I could do a whole 2 hours on just that right there. Them taking credit. Are you? I'm not going to get on that tangent because we've already been talking about
this. We've got to calm down. But we've got to calm down. How do we calm down?
Here's what I'll say real quick. If anybody, I know we've got a couple of listeners that live in the area, or who knows, God, we get thousands of listens and downloads per episode. So maybe someone might know something. I'm going to throw out the Maine State Police contact number, that if you know anything about this case, they urge you to call this phone number. It's the Maine State Police at 202-624-7076. 202-624-7076. If you know anything, if you know of anyone who knows anything and they're afraid to call for them, but that's the phone number, that's the contact. If you actually want justice for Ayla and you want to help, that's a real thing that you can do. So yeah. I just want to put that out there.
There's a reason why we don't normally say the phone numbers, is because a lot of these true crime podcasts are like, make sure you get justice for Ayla and contact this person. We know that you could Google that. We usually will say, like, if you fucking know something, you better say something. We don't usually go to all the effort, but since we have people in our audience who are convinced that they know that Justin DiPietro definitely killed Ayla Reynolds, emailing me, sending messages to Kendra, although we love feedback from our audience, you're not doing anything to honor Ayla by telling me about it. A podcast doesn't honor a little girl. Only a conviction of the person responsible, Justin DiPietro or otherwise, will honor Ayla. So get off your high horse. Podcast isn't the place to do it. I think we've ranted long enough.
Oh, God, yes. 48.
So, yeah, full show. Just try to fucking respond to that thing.
Thank you for listening to this rant. Yeah, and
thank you for listening to this important Ayla Reynolds update. Tonight we're doing the Klaus... Is it Klaus or Claus? It's Klaus, isn't it?
I think it's Klaus. That's how I would pronounce it.
I think it would have to have an E or something. No, it's Klaus. If it's German, it's just Klaus. So this is another story of is it familicide? Familicide? Yes. So we've talked about this before. Family annihilators, people that kill their entire family. There was that one guy that did it because he wanted money for the cam girl. Do you remember his name?
Grant Amato.
Yeah, he killed his whole family because he kept stealing their money and mortgaging their house. so they can have money to send to some girl over in the East, some Soviet Russian country who liked to perform heinous acts on camera for him. And he was deluded into thinking he had a relationship with her. Then there was Anthony Tote, who had some bad business dealings. It's kind of interesting to see a theme that money and failure are kind of common themes in these.
Yes.
But he killed his whole family. And there's disputes about what happened there. But basically, he overdosed his kids on Benadryl and stabbed them and his wife. And he also killed the dog. Anthony Tote killed his dog.
That's another theme that we see in these.
It's another theme. But he was still alive, right? Like, he stayed in the house with the corpses for a long time until investigators from elsewhere were looking for him for his financial dealings. They're like, well, you embezzled all this money and you've disappeared and you went down to your second home in Florida. And so they saw him sitting outside and then they went to go arrest him or interview him. And then they went inside and found the whole family dead. This is another one of those bizarre cases of a family annihilation. This comes from Canada, as I mentioned as well. We have had a few cases from Canada. We had the Cindy James case, the nurse from up there in Canada.
Then we had another one just before that. Getting to the point where the show where like everything's kind of blending together. So now I can't even remember.
Sorry. If you guys remember the name of the other case from Canada, go ahead and put that in the chats.
So sorry.
We do a lot of these. You know, I'm on over 400 podcasts a week now, so I can't remember every single one that I'm doing. Hey, Kendra, at one point I had listened to every single episode of Failure to Stop that had ever come out. I was such a big fan. And then I started making the show, and it became impossible for me to do it. We also switched over to having 19 shows a week. So,
well, Matt the Cop made it look really easy. So,
yeah, Mac the Cop sure did. Get a load of her. Could you believe her? Idiot.
This will all make sense in the follow-up episode.
This will make sense eventually. Watch the second episode. We're making references to the future. Now you know what it feels like to be around a time traveler who has insight of what's going to take place in the future. So stick around. If you want to know what the hell she's talking about when she says Mac the Cop, just keep watching episodes of True Crime Tonight. Anyway,
so let's get started.
This one's about Sandy Klaus and Gordon Klaus and Monica Klaus.
Sandy Klaus sounds a lot like Santa Claus.
It really does. I didn't even notice that till now.
Yeah. Continue, John. I apologize. Oh, for
well, no, I was sorry to, there's a phenomenon called man casting where it's like a man and a woman will be on a podcast and the man just does the entire thing and the female never gets to say anything.
It's okay. Go ahead. Introduce it. It's go. You're already started.
So in the province of Alberta, home to the Canada Goose, and the wild buffalo and the horned frog. There's a little town. And there's this huge 200 acre farm. By the way, this was back in the year of our Lord, 2013, I believe.
13. Yeah.
Yes. So Sandy Klaus, not to be confused with Father Christmas, 62 year old mom and her husband, Gordon Klaus, 61. They're grown up. They have been farmers their entire lives. They farmed their parents' lands, and then they took over their parents' farms and brought it all together in a super farm. And then they moved, and then they continue to farm there. Their daughter, Monica, works as an HR specialist at a firm somewhere nearby, and they live in the small town of Castor. Or it's within the postal zone of Castor. I'm betting it's not in city limits. That's a dispatcher thing.
There's a whole whopping 1,000 people that live there.
It's not a lot of people. Also on the property is one Jason Klaus. He's about 35, 38. He's 38 years old. He lives on a trailer on the property. And so Jason and Monica are adults. Obviously, they've moved out of the house, but the family is still pretty tightly knit in terms of the way they operate anyway. Like, they had just gotten together for dinner. It's right before Christmas. In fact, the night that this happens, the four of them, or at least Sandy and Monica, are going to decorate the Christmas tree. I know what you're thinking. Canadians celebrate Christmas too. There's a lot of weird facts about Canada. Canadians love their children. Canada, they drive on the correct side of the road. They're not carrying around boomerangs all the time. There's a lot of weird things about Canada, a lot of ideas that we have here. But anyway, they operate as a family. Neither Monica nor Jason have wed other people. And so they're still kind of close as a family. They don't have extended family yet. So Monica is home, and they have a family dinner, just like on Blue Bloods, because it doesn't happen in real life anymore. Just like on that TV show about a family that eats dinner together.
That's the whole premise of the show, is them eating dinner together.
That's all I've ever seen. And then Felony Melanie in the chats is like, I love Blue Bloods. I love when they eat together. And then I heard the show's ending and they're just like, oh, I'm going to miss a family dinner on Sunday night. Like, is that show literally about a family that's eating dinner together?
They finally finished their dinner.
Finally did. No more gravy boats for that Tom Selleck family. Anyway, I don't know anything about that show. Moving on. So also on the property, like I said, this is 200 acres. This is a huge swath of land, to the point where I think there may even be an airplane on this land that they might use for crop dusting. But I'll get to that. Is Jason Klaus, 38. Jason lives on the property. He farms the land. He works 7 days a week. He does a lot of chores. Farming is hard work, folks. I know, because it goes on all around me. I know because the farmers come by to mock me as I fail to efficiently mow my fewer than 1 acre of grass. They're like, you won't, if you had to raise soybeans, you would starve to death, son, they say. And they also say, we don't take kindly to your kind in this town. And you'll be working at the tar factory once this 911 fad falls through. And I don't want
to. And then they send their children to your house to mock you on Halloween.
That literally did happen. Of all the lies I tell, being mocked by the children of this town on Halloween was real. So anyway, he lives in a trailer elsewhere on the property. So he's kind of moved out, kind of not. And Jason is not necessarily a good guy. He's kind of a country boy, but as it turns out, Jason runs with some bad people. Mm-hmm. Jason likes cocaine, which is not good. And Jason hangs out with the wrong people, as I insinuated. But I can't wait to kind of get your take on this, because this is something I haven't made up my mind about. I don't normally do this show without making up my mind first. But one morning, after having dinner with his family, Jason gets a phone call from a neighbor saying, hey, there's a huge column of smoke coming up from your property at the house. Is your family there? And he says, sure enough, my father, Gordon, my mother, Sandy, and my sister, Monica, who doesn't normally live there, they're all three there. And the house is a pit of smoldering embers. The house is burned to the ground. Outside is what the Canadians call a jerry can, but what Americans call a Gerald can of gasoline.
That's a good one.
I don't know what it's called here. I think it's just like called it. A gas can. It's a gas can. The family dog, Keela, Chocolate Lab, I believe, has been murdered. The dog's been shot. Probably because the dog was a good girl. So we know already that this is foul play. Why? Because the house is burned to a crisp. The house was burning so hot that the volunteer fire department, it had to respond, made the decision to just let it burn. If they put water on it in this intense cold in December in Alberta, Canada, they would essentially spray a layer of ice on it from which nothing could be recovered.
Correct.
Water is normally pretty damaging to a crime scene to begin with. We talked about that with the Austin yogurt shop.
After
it had burned and after they had blasted it with water, that it obliterated quite a bit of evidence. But they know here that the house is a total loss. That they're very unlikely to get evidence out of there anyway, and that just spraying it down is going to complicate investigations later. There's no one alive to save, so they kind of just make sure it doesn't spread to any of the property or any other out structures that are there.
Well, one thing real quick, if you don't mind me interrupting you, that I found interesting when I was watching and reading material on this case is that the fire inspector mentioned that the gas can was a red flag. Obviously the dog being shot to death was a big red flag. But the gas can was a red flag because typically fuel for like a farm, right, is kept in large tanks like elsewhere that is more convenient to fuel equipment and all kinds of stuff. So having a gas can next to the house like that is a little suspicious. So obviously the firefighters and whoever was on scene realized, like, hey, this is probably an arson and we need to, like you said, preserve the scene by not spraying it down, and they let the whole house burn.
Something else that's interesting that we would come to find out perhaps at the time of the fire, because you can learn things from a fire while it's in progress. This fire burned exceptionally hot. It was burning with aviation fuel. We already knew that an accelerant was used, as you know, the jerry cans suggest, but that's why I think there was probably a crop duster somewhere on the property, because why would you just have aviation fuel? Well, the common use of airplanes out here is to crop dust. I mean, people have airplanes and you see, you know, smaller aircraft that go out there and, you know, they're chemtrailing everyone. And that's why everyone has autism and stuff. I don't know. Anyway, so that's probably where the aviation fuel comes from. Someone referenced it in a podcast, and I do love listening to other podcasts because they have such good information. They refer to it as jet fuel. I don't think a common person has access to jet fuel. Let's mention that this was probably not jet fuel. It was aviation fuel, which would be for a propeller plane, which is what you would use to crop dust with. So the dog's been murdered. So they find the remains of Gordon and Monica inside. They don't find any remains of Sandy. That's how hot this fire was. So let's talk about that briefly, because this has always been, it's interesting to me. A human body is basically a big watermelon. That's all you are. If I drop you off a bridge, you're going to break into a million pieces and ants are going to eat you. Where was I going with that? No, you're mostly water. And so to get you to burn, I have to have you at least 212 degrees, the boiling point of water, for a really long time to get you to get rid of all that water. Fire's obviously, you know, at least 450, 500 degrees. But in order for me to get rid of not only all the water in your body, but all the bones and minerals and hair and everything else, for that house to burn overnight, I think it actually burned for a couple of days, which also indicates how hot that it was. It was literally consuming every molecule of fuel in that house. It didn't just burn out at some point.
Right.
But her remains are completely gone. There's no teeth. And at least in the initial investigation, there's nothing that they find that indicates that Sandy was there. The investigation concludes that Sandy was at home. That's what Jason Klaus, the last surviving Klaus, says, is that mom was there. I just want to let you know how intense this fire was, is that we didn't find the mom.
Yeah, they never found any identifiable remains of Sandy. To this day, they never had. So
some people claim that they have. I know that Jason, who recovered in pristine condition, his mother's wedding ring and a second ring and a tooth, saying it was her tooth.
Mm-hmm.
Which if it's not her tooth, it's like, where did the tooth come from? In the words of the Big Lebowski, forget about the fucking toe, I guess, you know. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but
I love that movie, yes.
Favorite. So you let that go. But anyway, so Jason is brought in pretty early on because he behaves strangely. He immediately asks, well, did you find any shell casings? That's important because how did Sandy, Gordon, and Monica die? Did they die in a fire? He also asks, was it because of a defect in the coal furnace? Apparently they had up to 6 tons of coal down there, which if you live in Alberta and it's as cold as it was that night, I could probably burn 6 tons, you know, in a month, you know, because I get cold. Coal also tends to burn slow and it doesn't explode and it doesn't leave your house burning for several days. That's the whole point of coal, is that it doesn't burn hot and fast and burn out right away, right? Like that's how you get a steak, is that you can leave it on there for a couple hours.
Right.
Or chicken. You guess you went to the steak. But anyway. Well, I just don't want you to think I'm bad at cooking steaks, Kendra. I'm really good at it.
I believe you, John.
All right. Thank you. So he's behaving strangely. They're asking him questions. And here's another reference for you, if you like Coen Brothers. But he reminds me of Martin Freeman's appearance on the first episode of Fargo, where they say, like, did you have anything to do with this? No. And then instead of just saying, you know, no, my God, no, I had nothing to do with it. He just goes on and on and on and goes, no. They were my best friends. I can't think of a life. I can't think of a life without my family. You know, well, I mean, you know, of course my dad and I, we would get into a row now and then. And my mom, you know, my mom didn't like any of my girlfriends, but you know, no. And the only reason he could think that somebody would have done this is there's a taxidermied deer head somewhere in the house. This is a prize that he took while hunting in Utah.
Yes.
That he claims is worth something like $200,000, which even in Canadian dollars doesn't sound right. He's saying that it was close to a world record size of a deer. And he's recalling the story when the Klaus family was hunting in Utah, and then they took this deer that was amazing size. The problem was is that later investigators would look into this whole Utah thing, and then there's some doubt that he ever shot any. I mean, they were deer hunters, but there's some doubt that his claim that they had some trophy in the house that was worth killing for was never substantiated. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I think what happened with that was he did shoot a deer that was pretty, cause he was in a couple of like outdoor magazines about it, I suppose, but he was trying to say that this deer head was such a prize and such a trophy that the people that were present for it, for the hunt would for some reason want it. So that would be some sort of weird motive for them to come to Canada and kill his entire family. And naturally, the investigators looked into it. And when they went down to Utah to interview these people, they realized they hadn't been in Canada. Their passports, you know, they looked into it and it was immediately squashed.
Also, you know, there's other people that would have gone into the Klaus home and realized that they have this tremendous deer trophy who would have been better suspects than someone from Utah.
Yeah. Two random Americans that just happened to be...
So he comes up with this story. It doesn't make sense, and he's behaving suspiciously. After this, he takes possession of his sister's Ford F-150, tricks it out, and that vehicle gets repossessed because he's very, very bad with money. Then he also buys a Hummer and tricks that out with camouflage. But... Let's go to some of his more bizarre behavior, and this is where Kendra comes in. This is where her specialty comes in, not as a cop, but as a seer. A seer of visual things. No, what am I thinking of? No, this guy. So I guess this family was pretty spiritual, meaning they all believe in ghosts and phantasms and all that Scooby-Doo shit, hippy dippy bullshit that I don't go in for even a little bit. And here's the interesting thing. Jason starts telling Gordon's sister and other extended members of the family, because this is normal to them. He starts telling him that the spirits of his three dead family members have come to him saying, don't worry about it. We're going to take care of this. We as ghosts are going to avenge our own death. You just take care of the farm. You don't worry, Jason. We got this. And his family members also bothered to explain to him in detail, in such incredible detail later, that he's able to recreate it for a third party that we'll get into. What happened? This is the story as told by the ghosts of Christmas past to Jason Klaus.
Sandy Klaus.
Yes. Again, we're very thematic. I feel like we missed the season for this one because it happened at Christmas. Her name's Sandy Klaus, and now we've got this Dickensian tableau of revelations. So anyway, Jason says that nobody burned in the fire. It's important to know that your loved ones didn't suffer. They just got fucking shot in the head, you know, double tapped, apparently. Whoever did this entered the house, killed the dog, killed each of them in turn, and then strewn the house with aviation fuel, and then took the deer, lit the house on fire, and also took off with Gordon's GMC, his vehicle. So how did they arrive there, by the way? If it's that cold, how are you getting to a farm that is on 200 acres, not leaving a vehicle behind and also taking Gordon's car? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know what people think about it. I'm just saying what I have learned about this case. I don't know anything about the theories about why Gordon's vehicle would have been taken from the scene and the keys thrown into a ditch. It doesn't make sense. Kendra, do you have a theory on why that was even presented as evidence, or why the police would operate with that having been true? Or why it would have been falsified by a suspect in this case?
It doesn't make sense. Excuse me. It doesn't make sense that.
Kendra gets choked up by nonsense. So sorry there.
It is nonsensical because it doesn't make any sense. Why would, like you said, how could one travel such harsh weather conditions in the middle of the night, accomplish all of this, all of these atrocities, and leave with the vehicle, ditch the keys. It doesn't make any sense, especially if your motive is a deer head. I don't know.
Well, the other thing is that it is very cold. Like, it's something like minus 40 Celsius, which I tried to convert, and there's actually no way to convert that to Fahrenheit. So we can't understand in English how cold this is, but it's some sort of Canada definition of super cold. They have all these things called block heaters on cars, where basically if they don't plug in their cars at night, the cars will never be cars again. Like the antifreeze literally freezes, and the oil becomes solid, and the electricity that's in the chemicals becomes nothingness. So that's how cold it is up there. So I don't believe that someone's walking this great distance to go get this deer head that they would have to then carry from the scene after ditching the truck, or have some other vehicle meet up with them. We've already got some evidence it doesn't make sense. But anyway, he's telling all this to people that ghosts have told him this. And it makes no sense. And at one point, he's like telling various other family members things. He's talking to the Mounties. Every time the Mounties interview him, the story changes a little bit. He says that the reason why he's not talking to the Mounties about what the ghosts are telling him is because he doesn't want the Mounties to think that he's crazy, which, you know, all this information, of course, is getting back to the Mounties. But one thing that he does is he talks to this guy named Brady Flett. Who the hell is Brady Flett? Well, you know what? In a rare podcast move, I'm not going to tell you. Moving on. No, I'll tell you about Brady Flett. Brady Flett is Monica's boss. And Brady Flett really liked Monica as an HR lady. He was a rare boss that appreciated an HR employee. I don't know how that happened. Probably a weird Canadian thing. But Brady Flett appreciates the fact that Jason Klaus is now the last surviving Klaus. So he's lost three of his family members, plus the family dog. He lives and works on the farm. By the way, the farm also now doesn't have a house for him to live in because it's been burned to nothingness. And Brady Flett feels bad for Jason Klaus. I mean, he knows he doesn't have an income, like I said. So he gives Brady Flett something like $10,000, which I can't convert that to American dollars either, but I think it's some large sum of money, which also makes you suspicious because Jason inherits this $10,000 gift from Brady Flett, and now he's also inheriting his sister's Ford F-150, which he then tricks out in the style that he prefers, and then that gets repoed, and then he buys a Hummer, which I think also got tricked out. So Brady's got an issue with money, which were also, like we insinuated with the totes and with Grant Amato, that was his name, right? Money is a factor. So money is a factor in this case. So he's talking to Brady, and Brady gives him the money. But then he kind of goes away. I think he spends some money. And then he starts talking to Brady about how, you know, these ghosts have been telling me, you know, exactly what happened. But basically, this killer moved from room to room, annihilating my family members. And he's telling Brady Flett what's going on. And Brady's just like, this is kind of weird. It's weird that you're talking to me about the ghosts of your family, revealing what happened to them. It's strange to me. But I think Jason is talking to Brady and trying to convince them that he's on the side of good or whatever by explaining what's happening. But he's trying to keep this relationship going with Brady so that Brady will continue to give him free money for being the last surviving Klaus. Well, Brady goes to the Mounties and says, like, he's telling me some pretty strange stuff. Like, he's got a vivid account of the murders that he claims is coming to him through the supernatural. And the Mounties, unlike Kendra, are not be like, well, we definitely believe these third-party supernatural sources on this. So Brady agrees to become an informant, where basically he pumps Jason for information. He agrees to record their phone calls and all this. And at one point, Jason's giving him really, really, really detailed information. And Brady says, so how are you getting all this? This is pretty amazing. And Jason says, you know, I consulted a psychic, a medium, helped bring all this out. And Brady's like, you know, this psychic seems to know a lot. I think the Mounties should talk to her because she has like some really good insight into what's going on. Who is she? And Jason says, I don't know. And Brady's like, well, maybe they can find her. What does she look like? And Jason says, she looks like Aunt Jemima. And she wears a turban. You know, like psychics do.
Oh, yeah. Crystal ball and long nails.
But she said that if you ever come looking for her, that no one will ever see her again. So he literally said that the person who told him about the fate of his three family members was the pancake lady wearing a turban. Okay. So also there's this lady, just as a side note, who ran this, who created a true crime book, who's a source for many people in this case, called Murder on the Plains or something. And Jason also spoke to her and said many strange things, not the least of which was the psychic looked like Aunt Jemima with a turban. And she remarks, so the person that we're looking for who has keen insight into this case is a magical black woman in Alberta, Canada, and we can't find her. No one knows who she is. And also somehow Jason was able to look up psychics like in a phone book and find her, but now we can't locate her at all. I guess she was practicing on like a cart where a curtain is pulled back and she's inside and they do your tarot and then, you know, the horses take her out of town overnight. And
I love that she described her as a magical black woman.
Well, that's it. That's
so funny.
The magical black woman is a trope in fiction where you have a magical god lady, or like Guinan from Star Trek: The Next Generation. She's a magical black woman. She tells the crew what to do. I don't know. You ever watched TNG?
Did I ever watch what now?
The Next Generation, Star Trek, TNG.
No. But I know the magical black woman trope that you're talking about.
Sorry, I don't mean to fridge you. Or man cast you on this one.
Okay.
So she's telling, Jason's going around telling people that ghosts are telling him the details of the case and this magical black woman's helping him. Kendra.
Yes, John.
Just jump in here anytime. Like, what do you got? I can finish this out, but I want you to...
Because, well, when I was reading about this case, and by the way, this case was sent in to us by a fan. By
Oh, which fan?
He doesn't want me to reveal who he is.
Do I get to know?
He's one of our Canadian listeners, so there's a hint. Oh. But... When I was reading about it, I didn't really know much about it. I've heard of it, but it seems from a law enforcement perspective, because he also told this information to a fire, fire inspector. Am I saying that correctly?
I would say fire inspector is probably what they call it, but we would say a state fire marshal, someone who investigates
state fire marshal.
Suspicious fires.
And he talks to this, this person a lot. He doesn't want to talk to the Mounties, because obviously he's afraid he's going to get implicated in this. But he also tells the fire inspector this story about the ghosts. And when I was reading it and listening to Keith James is his name, the inspector, listening to him retell the account that was given to him by these ghosts of his family, I just remember thinking, like, this is a huge tip off that he fucking did this, because I feel like that's a way for some people experience like real hallucinations after they murder people of the ghosts, or perhaps they're actually being visited by the ghosts of their victims. And it's living with the fact that you had a hand in murdering your family. I feel like it's normal to cope with it by half-ass admitting it. Like, If someone came to me and said, oh, the ghosts of my family came to me and told me, don't worry, we know who actually did it, and then told me exactly what happened, and they were telling me, yes, they were all shot in the head twice and burnt to a crisp, I would be like, you fucking did this. Or you have something to do with it, because what an odd thing, and the fact that he thinks that that's going to work.
Just the fact that he won't shut the fuck up about it, because he talks to the news too. The news asks him, like, well, how are you going to spend this sad Christmas? Probably just on the farm doing my chores. And he talked to the extended family. He's talking to the police. He won't shut up about it. For someone who should be in grief, you should probably have a quiet period where you're only surrounded by your closest friends and maybe the family or whatever. But as months go on, his story gets embellished, and there's more details, and things are being misremembered and added and changed. And this is how you know someone is lying, and the police are wise to this. So the police bring him in for a polygraph at one point, and I'll just go through this part of the story real quick. But he fools the polygraph. And what he does is, just some pro tips for you if you're going to try to fool a polygraph. He goes in there, and apparently there's a butt part of a polygraph. Have you ever, you've been polygraphed before, right? Didn't you, for your law enforcement application?
They don't do polygraphs.
That's good.
We do CVSA.
That's because you do it in Florida, where Ron DeSantis runs everything and does it all weird and correct.
What does it have to do with Ron DeSantis?
Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing at all.
He's very vehemently against polygraphs. He's famously against them.
Well, anyway, so there's this butt part of a polygraph, and I guess if you clench your butt, even when they're asking you the control questions, that just makes you seem like you're upset by every question. And, you know, so he literally admitted this later, that he said every single time someone asked him a question, he would just clench his butt. And I guess that created a galvanic response throughout his body or whatever. Like, here's the other thing. Maybe it's only Canadian polygraphs that have a part that goes up there. I don't know. So maybe American polygraphs. Maybe that's why Canadian polygraphs are admissible in court, because they have the butt part. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that's the missing link or the missing plug.
That's the part Americans just wouldn't do. It's like, you know, this would be 100% if we would just do the butt part, but we won't do it. No, polygraphs are not admissible even in Canadian courts, just to make that perfectly clear. But I guess he got past the polygraph by just indicating deception or some kind of response in every question. He clouded the response.
So, okay, John, I have to make one little amendment to what you just said.
Oh, okay, good. I love to be amended. I'm like the Constitution, baby.
Okay, so Jason is becoming, and he is, like the number one suspect at this point for law enforcement. And there's multiple people that are involved in like some sort of, they're informants for law enforcement. Can you stop making fun of my hand gestures?
They're just so big.
What? My hands are so big, yeah. My hands are pretty big for a small woman. I've got big hands. But anyway, there is another person involved in this, and it's his friend, Josh Frank. Josh Frank is always around. He's always seemingly in the mix with this stuff, but he's very tight-lipped or tight-assed, because he is the one, he got polygraphed as well, and he completely passed. And he attributes it to clenching his ass cheeks together.
Oh, is he the one that was clenching? Okay.
Yes. And I only amended you because I wanted to put out there that this guy was also involved in it.
Yes. Well, I was getting to that. I was building. I was doing the slow build.
Okay. I apologize. I didn't mean to man cast you.
No. I like being amended, because like every once in a while I'll listen to our shows and I'm like, I have clearly misspoken or I said something wrong. And I, you know, we're here to back each other up.
I got you.
Thank you.
And my light just went out. And the whole next episode is
the whole next episode is us
kind of contradicting the statement you just made, where you like to be amended.
I know. Yeah. Get ready for it, folks. The double episode tonight's going to be lit. Anyway, Joshua Frank is someone who's substantially younger than Jason. I guess they've been friends since Josh was 14 and Jason was 21. So okay. If you're 21, you're definitely hanging out with someone who's 14, right?
Sure.
Normal.
Very well. I mean, they are in a really small town in the middle of nowhere.
This is where I'm going. We're going to circle back around to this later, because at first I had my mind made up one way and then I was confused later. So we'll talk about that.
Okay. Put a pin in that.
Jason and Joshua are friends. They like to do cocaine together. They run together. They both are two farmers, so far as I know. They're also Eskimo brothers.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Well, the only thing that really matters is that Jason has an on and off again relationship with some woman named Amanda, who runs the Cosmopolitan Hotel, which is a dump, according to Yelp. And Joshua also is going around bragging that he's sleeping with Amanda. And I guess there's no way to verify that they're, in fact, Eskimo brothers. But at some point, subsequent to the murders, the two have a falling out over these rumors that they might, in fact, be Eskimo brothers. They might both be involved sexually with Amanda. In fact, Joshua is living rent-free at the Cosmopolitan Hotel. And, you know, if she's running the place and he's living there, okay, you know, it's very possible that, you know.
Sure.
That he's laying some pipe there. I don't know.
John!
Services rendered.
I love it when you go blue like that. You never do that. It's funny.
I did it on last Thursday's episode. I said that being a Dallas Cowboys fan means you get blue balled every January. So Jason and Joshua have a bit of a falling out over this. It never comes to anything, but at one point Jason is saying, you know, I'm going to go beat him up. Never does. Never follows through with anything. And so there's some contention between the two, but they continue to be friends. Well, the police begin doing something uniquely Canadian. They get together and they drink in their Tim Hortons, and they're like, let's do something pretty Canadian to solve this, eh? And then they hatched a scheme. Kendra, I would like you to describe in great detail the scheme, because you're a policeman officer, and I think you could explain the scheme as good or better than I am.
Okay.
So please woman-splain the scheme.
So the scheme that they come up with is a tactic that's not allowed in the United States.
I've heard sources saying it was, but when I found out sources that said it was banned, I couldn't find any case law to say it was banned either.
It probably happens. Probably it happens in its own way. I mean, this is how you get information. It's an undercover operation, and they call it a Mr. Big sting operation. And what a Mr. Big sting operation is an undercover law enforcement officer poses as a member of a criminal organization, like a gang or whatever. This law enforcement officer then befriends the person of interest. In this case would be Jason.
So they're making a fake gang.
And yes, it's very West Side Story. A lot of snapping and.
Once you're a Jet, you're a Jet all the way from your first something breath to your last dying day, man.
Correct. So
yep.
They got their fop and their combs, and they're snapping at each other in the street. And essentially
going to Vietnam. Not even one.
They commit. This undercover law enforcement officer will stage fake crimes and have this person perpetrate these crimes with them to gain trust. And over time, basically, to vet this person into this fake crime organization.
Yeah.
They will get them to what?
I was going to say, Jason and Joshua, they're already going around doing cocaine. So they've already got a foot in the criminal world.
Correct.
And a way that they apply pressure is they say hey, just so you know, we've got sources inside the Mounties saying they've got new evidence against you. So
yeah,
may want to be careful.
Yes. So essentially over the course of several scenarios, they get these people in this case, it's Jason. So I'll just say Jason. They get Jason to essentially admit to conspiring to kill his entire family.
Oh, you cut out so much of the story.
At
one point, they open up a trunk saying, we beat a prostitute to death. Would you help us get rid of the body? They open up the trunk, and it's an undercover RCMP constable. She's a female. And she's all like, oh, I'm still alive. I'm getting better, And so the cop's like, you get out of here as long as you don't tell the real police what happened to you. And she's like, okay.
Yes. Well, they stage all of these crimes that aren't real.
They stage fake crimes. At one point, this undercover constable goes apeshit on someone else for parking too close to him. So he has a fight with another undercover constable in front of him. It's all this stagecraft. It's all this plays. I can't imagine how fun it would be to be as a cop who are just what are we going to do tonight to convince him that we're a criminal gang? And they just do fun shit.
It would be a lot of fun. It would be so much fucking fun
and
to do that.
And it's all criminally allowable gaslighting of another human being to make him believe that you are not the police, but you're the mob. And so
it's very much like anger management. It reminds me of Anger Management,
the film with Jack Nicholson, the golfer, but Jack Nicholson.
Yes,
I believe I got that wrong. Don't send me a message about that. I'm sorry, everyone. Jack Nicholson, not the golfer.
But the thing that go ahead.
I keep interrupting you. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. You're not interrupting me. It's fine.
I'm just having fun.
I know.
Anyway.
Not allowed to have fun here. This is court-ordered podcasting. No,
this is court-ordered. So anyway, now I'm thrown up. But they come up with all this fun stuff, and they're applying a little bit of pressure. So there's a carrot and a stick saying, hey, you can run with us. You could be a made man in small-town Canada gang. if you will do some jobs for us, And so eventually both Jason and Joshua get involved in this. And at one point when they tell him hey, just so you know, our source is inside the Mounties who's looking at you twos, guys. They think they have some evidence on yous. And Jason at one point is just like, Joshua is the one that killed him. He's the one that went through the house. So the obvious solution is just whack off Joshua.
Whack
I meant That's a It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia joke. That one time the gang gets whacked and they keep saying whack off instead of whack. But he keeps saying, you know, assassinate the assassin, kill Joshua, because sure. Joshua's the one that went through the house. And so what it all comes down to is this. This is the key element, unless you want to do the main part.
You're already on a roll, John. Just go ahead.
I'm sorry. Mr. Big picks him up and he goes, I'm Mr. Big. You know, I'm going to get you into this gang and what have you. But to solidify trust, yes, snapping, to be a jet, we need to know, you know, that you're an avowed criminal, that you killed a guy. We need to know that you're the real deal. We don't want no jabronis around here. And so,
why are they talking in like a Brooklyn accent in Alberta?
I don't know. So Joshua's like, man, I got a real good criminal resume. I got three homicides already. And then Mr. Big's like, well, homicide is one of the worst crimes. So he's really impressed. You know? So he leads closer to him with his big bulge hooder shirt. He goes, tell me all about it in great detail. But why would he do this, right? It's not just to establish his bona fides as a legit criminal person. He says, listen, I got this uncle. My uncle's dying of cancer. And Josh is like, well, I'm very sorry to hear that, sir. And he goes, don't worry about it. He had a good life of philandering and being a total criminal badass. And now he's going to do you a favor, see, because he's dying. And even here up in Canada, even though we're weird compared to the United States, we got this thing called dying declaration. It's basically a sin eater. He confesses to everything, and then the guy dies. He never goes to prison or nothing. Got this uncle. His name's Dave. He's going to die. Dave is gonna take your sins into the grave. So we need to tell Uncle Dave everything that you've done so that he can confess to the Mounties about the crime and get the heat off of you so you can work for a small town Canadian criminal gangs. It's almost laughable.
It's fucking hilarious.
But it's awesome. Good job, it's awesome. Canada. Fuck. I almost want to be a... I never wanted to be a cop, but I want to be a Mountie because I could do this.
You know what makes me... What's even funnier about this is that these two are absolute fucking idiots because it takes them like a small amount of time to just completely trust these guys and be like, yeah, I'll tell you everything.
These two farmers who have done cocaine. Well, that's what I was getting to. Two farmers who just do cocaine and just they're losers. Like one of them lives in a motel for free. So they're not big time anything.
Well, for sexual favors, at least.
Well, you know, that's a give and take quid pro quo type situation. You know, both are benefiting. I don't know. Anyway, so it depends on, you know, a lot of factors. So anyway,
sure.
So then they're like, but the thing is about them Mounties, they like them details, you know? So here's where it gets them. Like, you're going to have to really, really explain it so that Dave, who's dying, will understand. So he goes through it multiple times, explains that, you know, I got dropped off. I went into the house, shot the dog who was giving me all kinds of fits. I went in there and I went into the room where mom and pops is asleep and I snapped on the light. And Mr. Big's like, oh no, shit. You snapped on the light. You motherfucker. you stole coke killer motherfucker. You turned on the light. And then Joshua was like, fuck yeah, motherfucker. Turn on the light. I want to shoot him in the dark, you know? Anyway, it's stone cold to like turn on the light before you shoot two people into bed.
So I love this accent that you're having right now.
I don't even know what accent it is. I'm just channeling it. So he shoots both of them. Monica wakes up and she goes, oh, my Lord, it sounds like my parents have just been shot by multiple gunshots in this, you know, provincial, you know, small Canadian town. And then, So Joshua nails her, shoots her, which is sad, by the way, everyone. Like, I'm not making light of that. As much as I'm telling the story in a fantastic fashion.
We're laughing.
It really is
Josh.
Sad that it's very sad that these three people died. And it's all over money, no less, which we'll still get to. But aces the family, double taps them, and then takes the aviation fuel and sets it all on fire. He has them draw maps. Tells them every little detail, what color's the dog and all this, because the Mounties, they're going to want to know that information. I'll make sure they get that right. We've got to explain it to Dave multiple times. So at one point, they even get out a camcorder and they're like, we got to make Dave understand this. So you got to act it out. So they literally have Jason and Joshua do a little skit of how they murdered their family so that they can get it on tape to show a jury, not Uncle Dave, who's dying. So they reenact the murder in great detail. They've got maps. They tell everything that happened and why. And at one point, Josh is saying, you know, that Gordon got what was coming to him because I guess Gordon was stingy. Jason had been working on the farm for 38 years. He thought he was entitled to a piece of the action. He was not. He is entitled to live there for free in a fucking trailer and do cocaine and be a loser. He was mad at his dad for not giving him more money, which obviously I'm sure Gordon and Sandy are like, well, you'll inherit the farm. You'll inherit the land at some point. You could sell it off.
Well, also you do drugs. So also you do drugs. Give you a bunch of money.
And you bring girls over to the trailer. And even though you live very far away, we can hear what you're doing over there because this is a clear open plain. We don't like it. Well, I live on the plain. I hear things. Wind blows and I know what's going on in the next town over. So anyway.
Okay.
So anyway, so the family obviously doesn't approve of Jason because he's a fucking loser, and he's willing to join up with the he's willing to kill his family and join some Canadian mafia. He's a really bad guy. So at one point, Josh is explaining that, you know, Sandy didn't get what she deserved because she didn't deserve to die. Mentions nothing about Monica. They said that Gordon got what he deserved. So Mr. Big, who's, by the way, if he's not clear already, that's a constable of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And he goes, do you feel any remorse for this crime, which you definitely committed, which is against the law? And he goes, I feel some remorse, but I guess you could say I'm a stone cold killer. And Mr. Big's like, ha, that's right, motherfucker. You're a killer, aren't you? Say it one more time into my chest. I'm a stone cold killer, he says, with very
say
little
it
remorse.
Into my chest.
Say it in this box right here, you know, because it's an undercover operation. So. So they get him to do that, and then so here's the best part, because it's not really we talk about evidence sometimes and what constitutes evidence. So far, you know, this would never, I don't think all of this would really go in America, but we've got to figure out some key things. Where's the Ruger 9mm pistol that was used to kill the dog and the others? Well, he says I threw the pistol in the ocean. Or not in the ocean. There's no ocean
in the ocean.
I threw it in the ocean angrily.
Canadian Ocean.
It's in a river nearby. So they go down there. Dive team recovers the pistol. They're able to use stippling, rifling, or whatever it is that's on the pistol to determine this was the same gun that killed the dog. They're also able to locate the keys to the stolen GMC that Gordon had. Like I said, they took Gordon's vehicle from the scene. I don't know if it's a truck or an SUV, but they took his vehicle through the keys of the ditch. So the only people that can have the knowledge of where the keys are located and where the gun is located are the people that perpetrated this crime. This is the key part. It's not enough just to act it out or to say all these things, because anyone might lie to get into a gang. If you wanted to get into a gang, you might lie and say that you killed somebody, but right. you cannot produce evidence that is missing unless you're directly involved. So he knew where the keys were at. They found it with a metal detector. They found the gun in the water. So we've got the smoking gun. In other words, that these two definitely did it. And they're not just making up shit in order to be a part of a cool gang. So as it turns out, as we said, this was all a sting operation. The Mounties always get their man, as they say, and they've done it again. And this time they've never done it better. Fantastic work, gentlemen. Take a bow. I can't imagine. At one point, Jason was worried that this might be a Mr. Big operation, and he calls him up. And he goes, I just want to recant my confession that I made to you. And Mr. Big's like, ah, don't worry about it. We already got it recorded, so you're good to go. You know. So then they interview these guys, and sure enough, you know, they're presented with the evidence. There's not much they can do. Here's where it breaks down a little bit. There was a little bit of blood at the crime scene outside the house that was not the dog's. A firefighter saw it and marked it off. They knew it was blood, but they didn't know whose. If Jason drove Josh to the house, dropped off his friend to go murder his family, which is pretty cold, and then left the scene, he's still guilty of conspiracy to commit murder, felony murder, or whatever the Canadian equivalent of that is, you know. But the thing is that there was his blood at the scene. They ask him, like, did you get it hurt there? Did you step on a nail? Did you get home alone? Like, why is there blood outside that came from inside of your body? Which, there's a dog barking now. That could be the ghost, by the way, of Keela, who's mad that I'm telling the story in this fashion. But they at one point during the investigation, they also grabbed a straw from him that he had discarded, and they had proved that the blood was, in fact, Jason. So we know that Jason was at the scene of the crime prior to his arrival after the discovery of the fire. that he left some blood behind. So the story that Jason just dropped off Joshua and Joshua went in and executed everyone and stole the vehicle doesn't work. We know that Jason was out of the vehicle. And Joshua makes a claim that for years now, Joshua and Jason have had an inappropriate relationship that dates back to when Joshua was just a teenager. As I said, he was 14 and Jason was 21. Mm-hmm. When they confront him on this, saying, you know, has Jason ever raped you? Joshua's response is, hey, man, I ain't gay. Which is a weird response.
That is a weird response.
Because he's not saying that those things never happen. He's saying that he's not a homosexual, which no one accused him of homosexuality. They accused him of being a rape victim.
He's very quick to defend his sexuality, and because a lot of men equate their sexuality to their manlyhood, like being gay is seen as something that makes you less of a man, and being a victim of a rape or a sex assault is extremely shameful. So I could see that being like just an immediate defense of like, I'm not gay. That didn't happen.
Well, we're also the premise of it is troubled because they're conflating pedophilia with homosexuality. But my point is, he's not denying anything. He's just saying, I'm not gay. Like it's almost a tacit admission saying this happened, but I'm not gay.
Right.
So he's saying that Jason controlled him, that he always has, that he's used power and influence and sexuality and rape to control him. That Jason took him inside the house at gunpoint, forced Joshua to kill his three family members or face execution himself. That Joshua is sad that he didn't simply turn around and blast Jason instead, because then everyone would have survived and the only one who would have died that night would have been the bad guy. You got to remember, Joshua is the same guy who told Mr. Big, the undercover police constable, that Gordon got what was coming to him, and then he felt remorse about it, but only a little, and that Sandy didn't get what was coming to her. So he's already, for juice, for criminal credibility, has bragged about murdering these three people. So don't believe for a second that he was coerced into this, because at some point he's willing to use it to his advantage. And if this was something traumatizing for you, if you were marched around at gunpoint by someone you've known half your life, someone who has raped you and forced you to annihilate a family, you would not be using that to your advantage at any point.
Right. I agree.
So they were sentenced to life without the possibility of, or with the possibility of parole in some distant amount of time.
After 75 years, which...
75 years. The judge said that they've got to have some kind of sliver of hope in order to rehabilitate them. Look at the crimes we're talking about. This was all over money, right? Jason felt like he didn't have the money that was coming to him working the farm. Mm-hmm. He took money from Gordon. This is the ultimate motive, which doesn't matter when trying to prove guilt, but this is why. He took money from Gordon and Sandy, his parents, to fund his cocaine and other habits. We obviously know that he's into material things based off of the Ford and the Hummer that he bought, and just the cocaine and running out of money, the $10,000 that Brady gave him, and he needs to continue to try to suckle off of that teat. So he took money from the family. The family was about to find out, and that's why they all had to die. That's why it couldn't be Gordon and Sandy, just the parents. It had to be Monica, too. He had to get all three of them when they were at the house, because otherwise, Monica, the responsible one, is very likely in their will, and even if she's only going to get 50%, she's going to see all the books and realize there's a lot of money missing. So Monica's got to go as well. He has to kill all three of them to cover up his crimes, which he said he was going to pay back and all this. But it was all about money. Killed him for that. Killed the dog, too. So these people are not going to be rehabilitated. What's interesting is, and you're going to have to correct me on this if I got it wrong, but they did an appeal, and then somehow the Canadian Courts of Appeal is allowed to take it so they could say that you didn't get judged harshly enough. Because they're like, you guys got concurrent life sentences, but we're going to give it to you consecutive. Like, they like appealed, like, your honors, we got screwed a little bit. We was controlled. There was some sex and cocaine going on. We was confused. The cops is the mob, I guess. We don't know. And then the higher court's just like, you didn't get fucked enough. We are giving this to you consecutively. So you're going to serve three life sentences in a row. And then a third higher court and an additional appeal said, just let them do it concurrently. And so they went back down to the original sentence. But I like the fact that you could appeal a sentence, and in Canada, they could say that you weren't given a harsh enough one. I thought that was awesome.
It is
like,
awesome.
That's a good way to discourage appeals by thinking like the sentence that you get in a sense is a plea bargain because you want to push your luck, buddy. You're grounded. You're grounded for a week. Well, I want to appeal that. You're like, you want to go for two? Like, it's literally how Canada works.
Yeah.
They're like, you want to serve your grounding consecutively? Because we can make that happen, mister.
I like
you
know the that? I like that.
That's how Canada does it, apparently. I never knew that about Canada, but I guess
I like that. There's so many times where appeals have gummed up a lot, and there's a particular case that's actually local to me where the guy goes up for an appeal every like 4 years or something like that. Every chance he has, he goes and does it. And he was the mastermind behind the murder of five individuals in like a home invasion style. He basically was the ringleader of like three other people, and he beat him and his accomplices beat five people to death. And he just goes up for, he gums up the works. It's just the appeals process can be extremely taxing on the justice system. And I like the idea that of discouraging people to do that for certain crimes. I know it's part of the justice system. It's part of your right. Like, it's good in one sense, but when it comes to things like this, I don't think people should be encouraged to do that.
Well, take Charles Manson, right? He was sentenced to death. And then you had the 1976 case that placed a moratorium on criminal punishment throughout the United States, which meant his sentence got commuted.
Yeah.
So then after that, he's eligible for parole. And so like every 4 years, Charles Manson, Mr. Helter Skelter himself, with a swastika cut into his forehead, they bring him in like, all right, so ladies and gentlemen, before us today is Mr. Charles Manson, who has been in here for trying to incite a race war and organizing the deaths of several people, one of which was a pregnant woman. And so, Mr. Manson, why do you think you deserve to get parole today? I'll kill again if you let me out. Hey! You know, and it's just like such a waste of time, you know?
It is, yes.
But because he didn't even want to get out. But it's like, you know, you're not going to let Charles Manson out. But like, that's the process, right? You have to observe it. They had to go get him. They had to bring him down to the parole room. And we all know it's a farce that he's not going to get parole. I just love that in Canada, there's some kind of stakes that like, if you are going to push this, like, you know, if you're wrongly convicted, it's obviously worth it to you, but it's just like, just, you know, if you really did this, you could actually lose out even worse on this proposition, which again, yeah. they're doing something like 75 years. So I just thought it was great. Kendra, that's awesome. any closing thoughts on this, this truly chilling case of familicide from north of the 49th parallel?
I just think it's, familicide, family annihilator psychology is extremely interesting to me because all of them are so similar. There's always money involved. There's some sort of shame involved. I know in this case, Jason felt a little inferior as a man because his dad was, you know, basically at 38 years old, treating him like he was a teenager. Now that's probably because Jason was not super, he wasn't responsible. He didn't care as much as the others did. And he was blowing money on cocaine. He was forging checks and stealing money from the family. And that's like an ongoing theme with these things. Even down to like killing the dog. It's just very interesting to me. And if you are someone who believes in the supernatural, it almost feels like it reminds me of the movie Sinister, or there's plenty of other movies that are similar to this, but that's the one that comes to mind, where there's an ancient demon that walks the earth and possesses children to kill their entire family. And it's the same, different method, but same MO every time. And it feeds this demon the murders and the suicides feed this demon. And if you like to think of things like that or believe in them, it's a fun little thing. I guess fun is not a good word for that, but to put on these types of cases because they're all so similar, it almost feels like one person is like controlling a bunch of puppets. It's very creepy and tragic and interesting. I don't know.
There's a episode of The X-Files in which people are affected by tragedies and it makes them vulnerable, and then they get kind of infected by evil and then they go around to perpetrating these acts. It was a late series episode of The X-Files, but it was very, very interesting because you would see these people who were in bad situations and then they would change and they would become bad people and harm other people. And
yeah.
It's the idea that evil is like a virus that could be transmitted from person to person. Anyway, nobody cares about the X-Files except me for all time. Coming up next is another episode of True Crime.
Bonus.
I want to say before this bonus True Crime airs, I want to tell you something from the bottom of my heart. I love you guys. I'm happy to have fans that like this podcast. I like that I'm able to tell a story and that Kendra is able to tell a story that engages you to the point where you would talk to us and tell us what you think. And I also want to say, I got upset. And what you're about to hear is a little bit of a rant. So
I did too. And we do love you. Mom and Dad love you so much. And
you're not the cause of our going our separate ways.
Right. It's not your fault. It's just the fact of the matter is that we just don't like, we're disappointed a little bit.
We are disappointed in you. As our podcast children, we expect better.
We have to have a family meeting and we get, sometimes Mom and Dad get very passionate because we care about you and love you so much. And we just want you to be accurate and we want you all to have a good time. So we're just going to have a little family meeting. That's all.
About Kendra's ethnic slurs. She's from the South. She's not taking her meds.
What?
There's all kinds of reasons why you need to just let her off the hook. Okay. So sorry about the slurs. Just want to say that in advance. There's another episode of True Crime coming up right after this. We want to remind you that after tonight's special double bonus, double the fun, double your pleasure, double your fun with Spearmint Double Mint Gum. There's more True Crime. Tomorrow is Wednesday, and we're going to have Last Call for you, which is all the news you need to be informed, but without being depressed and insane like the other news outlets. Eric Tanzi is going to bring you up to speed. Mm-hmm. Then on Thursday, we're going to talk about sports still happening. So we'll keep you up to speed on that. Maybe talk some baseball. Maybe talk some spring league football. Friday, Eric's got a case. Oh, my God, this case. I cannot believe he's covering it. It is going to make your soup that's your brain boil and shoot out the bread of your ears. This case, I can't believe. I'm not even allowed to talk about it. I shouldn't have even said that, but this Friday show is so amazing. If you're listening and you're driving, you will wreck your car.
Wow.
And then on Monday, we'll be back with comedy. And Tuesday, we're going to come together and figure this show out and how to do it in a new and better way. More accurate, more detailed, less stupid, more togetherness, and more importantly, next week, more Kendra. She's the true crime girl.
I'm here the entire time. I don't know how you could get more of me.
All right. Possibly even more. Thank you for listening. We appreciate you every week. Thank you. Like I said, next episode up right now. More true crime. Guns up, giddy up. Good night, America.
Good night, America. Good night, John.
Good night, Kendra. Don't get yourself true crime, Will.